I have had a Patreon now for years and doesn't really do a lot. I have over 500 episodes of Beyond the Playlist. And iTunes has 150, 160 available at any given time. So I've decided that I'm going to start putting my old episodes up on Patreon. There are some things that I'm going to be putting up that never saw the light of day on the Patreon. I'm planning on doing a Patreon feed for it. So if you're interested, head on over to patreon.com/jhammondc and check out the Beyond the Playlist Patreon. And if you find any value in it, toss a buck my way. I'd really, really appreciate it. And I thank you. Joining me on Beyond the Playlist is Dunna A. Vlass. She is a pianist and an amazing talent, and I appreciate her being on. So how are you doing?
I'm really well. Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to talk to you, and I love the show. Such a well-produced show. I really, really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much. I was going through doing some research on you, and you are a highly decorated performer. Like, you're no joke, the real deal.
Oh my God, no pressure. Thank you.
I don't mean there to be pressure at all, but oh my gosh, you have scaled all kinds of mountains, and everyone knows exactly, seems to know who you are and how big of a deal you are.
Okay, thank you.
So the fact that you're on my rinky-dink little show makes me feel really proud.
Oh no, please, I'm delighted to be here. I really don't believe in that kind of social hierarchy.
Well, as we get started, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got started in music and performing.
Wow. I was born in France, actually. I was born to a French mother and a Greek father. And, you know, I'm actually a triplet. So we lived in France, my brothers and I, with my parents, until my father pursued or fulfilled the dream that he had had, I believe, since childhood, to work for NASA. And so he was working for the French government in France and had an opportunity to work for NASA. So we emigrated. And initially, the job was meant to be for a couple of years, but we never left America. So I mostly grew up in America. My musical training was done here. And with the exception of my scholastic training, the school I attended was actually a private homeschool. So my parents were my teachers, actually, for both of my brothers and myself. And I think that offered a really unique opportunity for me as a budding pianist to spend more time at the piano and be maybe more creatively focused than a lot of kids who would have been perhaps overwhelmed with school obligations and social activities that might distract them from their own creativity. My own path was really based on my own choosing. I could spend as many hours as I wished at the piano or painting or learning to sew, and I was always extremely creative. So the lifestyle that my parents gave us afforded me a lot of exploration in those realms. And I don't mean to say that, you know, there's a right or a wrong path for school, but for myself, I feel as though my creative path was facilitated by the fact that I was homeschooled. Whereas my brothers, I think, would have, and probably still today, would say they'd prefer to have had a public school education with more school sports and more socializing. We did socialize. There was no problem. We had friends, you know, in the neighboring homes and friends who went to school whom we saw on weekends. But maybe it's different for boys. Perhaps they're more attached to, you know, a little bit of a sense of belonging to a tribe and having a school team to root for.
Well, that makes sense. I wasn't that way. I mean, I went to almost a different school almost every year.
Oh my goodness. You were the child of a military family.
Yes. And so I went to three different schools for sixth grade, two different schools for seventh grade.
Oh.
I was overseas for most of my academic career in Germany and around Europe, and then graduated from high school in Hawaii, and then
marvelous.
Yeah, so, and then started college. And so you're right, though, your academic settings affect how you view the world and how you approach things going forward, because mine is always about the sense of adventure and this sense of wanting more information, because every time we move, we were moving into a new situation.
That makes you enormously adaptable as an adult, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yeah. So it
and
does...
you must have had an extraordinary experience of multiculturalism throughout your education.
And also, it gave me an idea, though, because now when I see the world, so for so long when I was growing up, I was always in a minority position, no matter where we were, because I was the one I was the fish out of water. And mm-hmm. so it really gave me an ability to empathize with other people and see other stories and see other sides of things. But I wouldn't have gotten it if I'd just been in the same town for 12 years straight.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. Yes. Was it easy for you to find friends and make friends quickly?
Well, so it wasn't initially at first, but when I was in about third, fourth grade, I realized that pop culture was the key. Mm-hmm. So I became really adept at learning about music and movies and books and TV shows. That way, when it came time to interact with people when I moved, I actually had the kind of litmus test of pop culture to kind of figure out where similar people would be. And I can't tell you how many friends I built because of a love of Star Wars or a love of Spider-Man or whatever it was, because that's, you know, you just found the people you could talk to about that.
Yes. That's wonderful.
As you started learning and progressing as a musician, what with the entire palette of choice of direction and style to go, how did you land where you landed?
So my musical path was, again, largely determined by my heritage and my parents' own predilections. So while you determined as a child how quickly you could relate to others and connect in the pop world and popular culture, I did not need that for whatever reason. Perhaps because I was friends with a lot of the girls in my own instructor's studio, classical music was cool. And I did not seek other genres until I was at least a teenager. So I have a very firm foundation in first classical experience and listening and repertoire. And then as a teenager, I went the route of classical crossover, Celine Dion, all of that. You know, if everyone would probably remember in the 90s, there were all those breakout hits with Andrea Bocelli and... Mm-hmm.
Josh Groban was all the rage.
Groban, of course. I still love these artists. They're so remarkable. I appreciate, from a classical perspective, I can relate to their training. But then from a more pop perspective, I appreciate that, you know, the melodies are simpler and the musical structures are more accessible and it's more relatable. It's easier to listen to. You don't have to really learn the music to appreciate it. And so I really connected with all of that. And then, like a typical rebellious teenager, I went into appreciating, this was later teen and of course my collegiate years, I went into appreciating all forms of world music and reggae. And of course I was aware of French pop and traditional French songs all along, but I never let go of the classical
world. So as a rebellious teen, you're busy listening to ska as your big push against the norm.
Right, exactly. I didn't quite go into metal. My brothers went there, but I didn't.
my mom was a big fan of old style musicals and R&B and those kind of things. And my dad was at the Monterey Pop Festival. So a wide variety of music was in the house.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, they both really like ABBA. And when we were in Germany, we were knee deep in ABBA tapes all the time. So ABBA's a mainstay as far as my musical love. I freaking love ABBA. But what's funny is now that I'm older and I have my experience in theater and musical theater, and I have my experience learning how to play harmonica and being a professional harmonica player, I really love these bands that do complicated time signatures and movements. And on one level, you listen to it and go, wow, these guys are really technically proficient and they can write a good song. But when you start listening to it and paying attention to, wow, they shifted this here and then it changes there, and you start taking it apart, and then you really start appreciating the work and the effort that goes into it. So there's a lot of similarity between, you know, progressive metal and even types of metal and classical music. Mm-hmm. It's all about showing off what you know, and in many cases, playing what other people can't play.
I think you're making a remarkable argument for children to be exposed to as many genres as possible.
It's absolutely true.
There's a whole musical language that spans the globe that only people who've really invested in it can be part of this club. And I think it's so beautiful. We need to grow our membership. Let's bring more musicians into the world.
On a website that you link to, I think it's from your Facebook mm-hmm. page, you were talking about the importance of the first piano teacher.
Mm.
And there's a TED, you link to a TED talk. And I have to admit, yeah, I think if I had had a more relatable, I don't know, if I had had a piano teacher, my first piano teacher that fit my style better, I probably would be more involved in piano. As it is, I know just enough for people to go, oh, you play piano? And I go, no, not really.
That's not bad. It's a good start. Oh, I wish I could do that with more instruments. The piano is the only one I really studied.
Yeah, it's really funny. I can sit down at a piano and I go boom, 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 and I'm like, oh wow, you're really good. I'm like, no, I'm not. I believe me, this is me understanding again the basics of the circle of fifths and some intervals. And other than that, I got nothing.
How's your technique?
Believe me, I don't even know where fingers are supposed to go. And my posture sucks. Let's not even start on that.
You know, I teach, right?
I do. I saw that.
Oh, no, I have all the sympathy in the world. I teach all ages. I have many, many adult students whom I adore. They're dear friends of mine through just the process of seeing them every week. And then, of course, I work with children. And so I'm totally not judgmental on any of this. I completely understand, you know, your struggles. And I support if you decide that, you know, you want to explore music and bring piano back into your world, you know, absolutely with, you know, great enthusiasm and understanding. I applaud you for wanting to do that. And no judgment, you know. I really think this is probably the biggest misconception about classical instruction, that you have to be really good to be worth your time. And that's really not the case. I think any degree of learning in any field is worth the experience.
And especially when it's something like music, because when it's something that's non-pressured, something you want to do, something that's creative and expressive, it lets you kind of emote in ways you're not used to emoting and experiencing things you're not used to experiencing. I mean, everybody has a chord progression or a series of notes they play that makes them feel like a rock god, no matter who you are, no matter what instrument it is. When you sit down to play it, you do that thing that makes you feel like you know what you're doing from the beginning.
That's
a feeling you can only get when you do that. It's not like you get that after you mowed the lawn really well. You.
That's true. it does feel good. And I think this is another argument for anyone to study things well and learn to be good at something. There's such a deep sense of fulfillment, a sense of self, and I think a deep-rooted growth for future self-reliance when anyone gets to experience what it means to be proficient at something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Whether that's music or anything else.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, I mean, for me, music was one of those things that when I was trying to figure out sight reading, I realized two things. I realized I have a really good memory because I'd never really conquered sight reading.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, the sight reading was still a foreign language to me. And I admire people who can sit down and identify time signature, key signature, and start playing as if it's been in their fingers their entire lives. That's an actual enviable feeling I have when I see that happen.
But then there are those who don't know how to memorize to save their lives who will look at you, or those who can just hear something and play by ear and think, oh, I would kill to have those skills.
So speaking of skills, do you have, I know that you're very skilled as far as, you know, playing things that are written. How are your improvisational skills?
I was never taught improvisation. And I really regret that. Of course, it's just different from, had I been educated musically in Europe, I would have had a very different training. So I can tell you about that. if you like, but you know, the differences between education in the musical realm of Europe, or at least France and America, you know, I had the path of private instruction once a week with a very fine teacher whom, well, my very first teacher, I only was maybe 1 year with her, but then I moved to a teacher whom I actually remember and with whom I stayed, you know, throughout the remainder of my training until college. And, you know, she did what she could with 1 hour lessons to teach a little bit of theory and basic technique, but there's just not enough time in 1 hour per week to do repertoire, especially advanced, you know, level classical repertoire. I was doing competitions and, you know, it's very limiting to only have 1 hour. Whereas in Europe, for a student who's taking music lessons seriously, they're at the conservatory at minimum 3 hours a week. That's three separate days. And so all of a sudden, with three times more time, there can be classes in chamber music, improvisation, obviously, you know, theory and composition, and applied performance. So the level of training, the level of preparedness of a, let's say, a 17-year-old who's finishing high school in Europe is much more sophisticated, much more advanced level of training than there is in America. And American universities, because we don't really have conservatories here, we have a couple, but they're not structured the way things are in France. In France, the conservatory education is pretty uniform across the nation, whereas here it's very much dependent on the school. And when you reach a university level here, all of a sudden there, you're trying to catch up and learn and quickly adapt to a whole other set of skills that would have already been taught in Europe by that time. Yeah, I think it's a worthwhile difference to note. And the other important thing to remember is that in Europe, if you do a degree in music and then you go to school for musical performance, all you do is music. You're not learning all the general education requirements that are happening for at least the first 2 years in undergraduate studies in America, where suddenly you're studying history, you're still doing math courses, you're doing astronomy. I loved all of the other extracurricular outside of music subjects, but I admit I would surely have practiced a great deal more even than the 3 or 4 hours a day I was already practicing, if I had not had at the collegiate level all these other obligations. So it's worth noting, because when you go into competition as, let's say, a 20-year-old in America, and it's an international level competition, you're competing with people who have done nothing but music for the last handful of years, whereas you have had to study advanced coursework in history, English, geography, whatever. And it's a very, you know, I think it's a very beautiful way to educate people. I think it's important to get that, but it's not a fair competition when you're trying to compete at the international level.
No, and I think there's something to be said about having a rounded education and having to know a little bit about everything. But at some point, I do think there needs to be an adjustment so that when people are showing either a predilection or an interest in something over everything else, they're allowed to shift to focus just on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because even when I was in college and I was, you know, headlong into my sociology major, I still had to take a math class. I'm like, come on.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Come on, people.
Yeah, but you had to do statistics in your sociology
class. Yeah, well, that's a different class, though. In that class, the teacher's like, look, there's going to be four of you in this class who actually have to use statistics every day. So everyone in this class is getting a C unless you really screw up or you excel. And then it's okay. I got a B+. I'm like, okay, great. I'm done.
Oh, good. That's a cool teacher.
You know, he worked in the field and he understood that literally of the class of 25 people, four of them were going to end up working with statistics as part of their main job, which is absolutely true. Everyone else is going to be therapists or counselors or whatever. And a passing knowledge of statistics is great, but to be actually be the thing you do, it's a small number. Now, as you go through and you're performing and you're doing these things, when and how do you go about then writing, composing your own things? How do you pull that information together from yourself and spit it out musically?
Oh, wow. That's an amazing question. I'm quite sure I've never been asked. Thank you for that. Well, as a whole, I have stopped performing. I've been dealing with some autoimmune issues for quite some time, and it's made really practicing repetitive motion incredibly difficult. So most of my energy that would have been spent learning repertoire for concerts, you know, performing the great masters, I'm not doing that any longer. That the time that I spend at the piano now is typically working on repertoire that I'm preparing fingerings and marks for my students. So I still go through all that, you know, those amazing classics, which I adore and are deeply fulfilling, but I never have to practice them to an extent that it's taking a toll on my fingers and my health. So the time outside of that is usually in the evenings when I've finished my day's work, so to speak, teaching, and I can then really get into a beautiful creative space, a really deep appreciation for what I want to express. And often I find myself gravitating towards the music that I most listen to, that I most teach, which is the 19th century in general. So that would be Chopin and Liszt and Brahms. Those composers tend to speak more deeply to my soul. And I think that it's not an accident if that comes through in my playing or in my composing.
I was going to say that I'm a big fan of Chopin. I always have been. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, there are things that I listen to on your website and throughout the internet. And I'm like, oh, wow. I kind of have a feeling that got pulled from some inspiration from somebody I like. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad I'm not wrong.
Absolutely. Not at all. Not at all. My music is most compared to Chopin, Liszt, Brahms, even Rachmaninoff. And I am so honored by those comparisons. It's not a conscious choice necessarily to imitate these. There are exceptions. I've been writing a number of nocturnes over the years. And of course, there's no way to write a nocturne without realizing that that's a nod to the great nocturnes of Chopin.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a piece I wrote that was specifically meant to follow a composition by Brahms. I don't know if you're familiar with his really famous Intermezzo, Opus 118, number 2.
Not by name, but I'm sure.
Not by name.
If I heard it, I'd know it.
You should hear it. Yeah. Exactly. So that is a piece I particularly adored. I've performed it and taught it many, many times. I know the piece very deeply. And I always adored the second theme from that particular work and always felt that it remained undeveloped. It's not a criticism of Brahms at all, but I just always wished that he had done more and expanded on such a beautiful melody. And one day I just found myself improvising on it at the piano. So I've told you, you know, I don't improvise, but when I'm composing in front of my, you know, my four walls of my studio, that's fine. I'll improvise. And that was the foundation for thinking I really need to write a piece to develop this melody for my own joy. This is for my own enjoyment. And I conceived of this work that should be sort of a follow-up. In an ideal setting, in a concert setting, you would hear the Brahms Opus 118, number 2, followed by my intermezzo, which borrows the thematic material, you know, just 8 measures, mm-hmm. and then develops them into something like a piece of equal length and equal standing in terms of constructive elements with multiple interweaving melodic lines and the lush harmonies that I adore from Brahms.
J'irai par la montagne.
When you are composing and you're writing your own stuff, do you have a key signature you like to write in and then find out it might not work or it does work? Or I mean, because everything, I mean, really, there are melody lines that if you put in A minor, don't work. Mm-hmm. If you drop them into A flat, they all of a sudden the best.
That's a brilliant question. And again, thank you. I've never been asked that except sort of in casual conversation with friends discussing composition processes. I have been blessed in a couple of ways. I have never had to transpose a piece out of key for a change of instrument. So that's useful. That's just a good, you know, lucky thing. And then the majority of my writing has been really geared towards performers that I know. And I tend to already know their best range, and I fit within that, the key relationships that fit within their ranges, primarily working with vocalists. So I've never had to move things into a different key. And if I'm writing for the piano, it makes sense pianistically because it's naturally what my hands are already doing.
Yeah, because what you write on affects how you write.
Absolutely.
And also, if you know who you're writing for, it affects who you write, because that does make sense. But even just something as simple as a simple melodic run in C takes on a very different tone if it's in B flat. And I'm just wondering if you've ever experimented with that, or if you've ever had that happen where like, oh, I like this, but let me try it over here first to see if it really belongs here.
I've only a couple of times considered moving things, sometimes by just a step, and I've never been able to move away from the original key comfortably. So you're right. What you're observing is absolutely correct. I think once something has found its home, its comfort, its place, and its color, creatively it loses a shine when it gets moved.
Yeah, so, and that's true, because once you've heard it the one way that came out spontaneously, it kind of locks in. But I also know plenty of people who write things and like, man, I really have to beat this into submission to make it work. And sometimes it's just a matter of changing keys on it or changing, I mean, even changing intervals is enough to, you know, open it up and make it feel better.
That's just part of the composition process where you realize, oh, this will feel so much better, you know, in this.
It's like this interval will sing better. It's like all of a sudden adding your pinky to a chord. All of a sudden you're like, wow, that's so much better.
Something I find myself often doing, and this is just my own predilection as a composer, I tend to use you were asking me about key signatures. I don't know why, unless I know I'm writing something for sort of a student level composition, I typically don't use key signatures with few sharps or few accidentals. I gravitate towards a larger number for whatever reason, and more often towards flats than sharps. But sometimes I work myself through key progressions into places where I end up having to use the enharmonic spelling of notes, just because too many double sharps is mind-numbing.
I see you doing that just to kind of upset the transcriptionist and having finale blow up and go, nope, I'm not doing that.
I was writing a piece, I'm still working on it, but a couple of days ago, I was finding myself writing a ton of E sharp minor chords. So now you're reading what looks like F minor on the piano, but it's E sharp, G sharp, and B sharp. And it's just really a struggle to read it and play it successfully. So I ended up, you know, having to really consider whether I should change my key signature completely. And I'm still deciding because of the convoluted mess of chordal things that I'm doing in that piece. I have to give up one problem and create another. So I have to decide what to do there.
As you're writing, I know you're primarily thinking about the bass and the treble of a piano staff, but do you think about other instruments and arrange for them to be brought in later so you can spread out your sonic range through other instruments as well?
Mm-hmm. Usually when I'm writing a piece of chamber music, which I've been doing a lot of for the last few years, it's an enormous joy, I do write in the additional part from the beginning. So when I compose in a very old-fashioned manner, I literally sit at the piano with a pencil, a huge eraser, and staff paper, and I write things by hand. So I create the staves right away for the viola or whatever other instruments are going to be included in the piece, and I write it out immediately. I very rarely add another instrument in retrospect because there's not usually room. My music is pretty dense, and so if I don't plan space for something immediately, I've usually filled that range, and I don't want the piano to be stepping all over the viola or the violin to be competing with the soprano.
Well, and that's also the thing that's really kind of the benefit and the weakness of the piano is it fills the entire sonic spectrum. Mm-hmm. And you can write for it and fill the entire spectrum, something like Gershwin does, or mm-hmm. you can have it be very sparse and have everything fill in around it. And mm-hmm. it's a style choice and it's a composition choice, but it is the benefit and the, I don't call it weakness, it's the mm-hmm. it's the obstacle.
It's a challenge.
A piano provides because it can fill up everything you need. It can go down and hit the bass notes and you can use it percussively. And you can go way up to the top and cover all these notes that only dogs can hear. And the ones that no one plays. So it's the ones that the ghosts hate and yeah. Ghostbusters. So it covers the entire range. And your style of composition dictates how much of that range you're going to use at any given moment.
And because I'm a pianist, I put enormous pressure on the piano to hold things together.
Well, I know guitar players do the same thing. They're like, they're writing, four guitar parts to fill all the space because they're guitar players. They're putting all the weight there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're such an astute observer. I really appreciate how much you just picked up on in writing in general. It sounds as though you've attempted composition.
Oh, I have, and it's a miserable experiment. Every time I've tried, the two things that always get me are melody lines tend to evade me. I cannot create a solid, good musical sentence to save my life. Now I can build chords around it. I can string chords mm-hmm. together and make things sound really cool as far as like moods and pads and all that kind of stuff. But putting a melody on top of it, I cannot get a melodic sentence to save my life. Not one that I feel like is good.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you just need to collaborate with singers or instrumentalists like flutes and violins that do just that. Send them the beautiful foundation and let them improvise something on top.
And I've even tried the thing about, you take the chords and you pull out the top notes and you use that to build a melody. And then you can be different inversions of it and try different notes mm-hmm. to have fit the thing. And it always just ends up sounding 4/4 guy banging on a piano.
Oh. Wow.
But I understand I have a knowledge of the theories behind how it all works.
Mm-hmm.
But putting into action is always harder than talking.
Do you yourself sing at all?
Oh, no. I was told by my mom not to sing in church because I would offend God.
Oh, that's harsh. No, I mean, I really would think maybe if in the privacy of your own space, if you could start by actually literally just singing, or I do this all the time when I'm driving, just play melodic lines through your lips, just play out something, little fragments. And then if you find something that's got a little bit of a hook to it, just record it.
Yeah.
Turn on your, voice recorder on your phone and then let that be the foundation for something that you'll come back to. I have a whole folder in my phone of musical snippets that I've sung in And I can go back to going, oh yeah, there's that. And then what you just described, you harmonize it and you've got the, you know, the basis for, often it's just 8 or 10 measures, but it's enough to build a piece.
Yeah. No, and it's something that I'm busy doing a lot of other things. So it's not things I tinker with a lot, but when I have time or when someone, you know, issues a little, hey, why don't you try this? I'll go and try for a while and realize, you know what? I should have paid more attention to that keyboard class I took in college.
But so what about all your harmonica playing?
So for me, this is a weird justification, but that holds a different place in my head for me because I see that as creating hooks and noodling and mimicking vocal lines that I'm hearing and soloing mm-hmm. and all that stuff. It's not creating a melody line. I don't see it as carrying the melody. I always see it as accenting the melody. I always see it as enhancing rhythm or filling empty space. I don't see it as I've never been the one who carried the song with melody on the harmonica, if that makes any sense.
No, of course. If that's completely what you were doing, then I understand that's a foreign concept to you.
Thank you.
Well, as we start getting ready to wrap up, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you, follow you, get your music, find your music, listen to what you do, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you. Well, I've got several albums out. I've got 5 albums of my own. Most of the first albums I released were piano solo projects. The first album was a collaboration with a wonderful German composer called Stefan Benneking, who lives in Berlin. And that's a collection of waltzes, very charming, very accessible for listeners. And then I released 2 albums of solo piano music. The first one of my own, completely my own compositions, was called Celebration and Commemoration. That was a project I shared the performance and the recording with a Spanish pianist called Carlos Marquez. Just that's actually the album on which the piece I referenced earlier, my idea to expand on Brahms, is on that album. And then the next solo piano album I did, that was 2017, I recorded everything on that. That's trilogies. It's a collection of sets of 3 nocturnes, 3 fantasies, 3 preludes. I'm very, very proud of this album. It's for me, it was a triumph as a composer to put together those traditional structures of music and to do, you know, sets of 3 for each of these 3 huge piano fantasies, 3 substantial nocturnes. And that's, for me, that was kind of an album that defined where I felt I wanted to go as a musician, as a composer. And then I did an album of piano and violin duets with this beautiful violinist of the LA Philharmonic called Misha Lefkowitz. And that album is called Solstice. And that's also on all the streaming platforms. Then last year, I released a whole new creative direction, which is My Path Now. It's an album of art song that kind of blends elements of chamber music, vocal art song, with a few piano solos, like palette cleansers in the album. And that's an album that really celebrated my French heritage. That was called Poème. And everything on that album was designed to have been inspired by poetry or to be sung poetry. That was with the amazing Grammy-winning soprano Hila Plitman. There were a couple of tracks with additional soprano lines for my other best friend, the extraordinary soprano Sangeeta Kaur. Someone else I really feel that I should put you in contact with for your podcast. The pianist who shared that recording with me is just a gem in my life.
Robert Feast. And this year, in just a couple of months, this summer, I'm releasing the continuation of that creative ideal of mixing vocal works with chamber music. And the upcoming album is called Mythologies. That's going to be an honor of my Greek heritage, celebrating my father, who was born on the island of Ithaca in Greece, which you may know, it's the island that was once ruled by King Odysseus mm-hmm. of Homer's famous Odyssey.
Yeah.
And so that album is in mastering right now. It's really exciting. The artwork is extraordinary. I've commissioned brand new artwork by a beautiful visual artist called Greg Spolenka. And I'm so excited to share this. This is a huge, huge triumph for me as a creator. Most of the music on this album was 3 years in the making. And recording it through a pandemic was really an adventure.
I bet.
This past year has been just really amazing. And so just I'm so, so pleased that this is coming up. That album will be a digital release. I'm not sure I'm going to be producing physical copies. The label that's releasing this has said they just want to do digitals, and it has something to do with the production line being affected by the pandemic. So if I do get some physical copies made, they will only be available through me directly. And I will only make very, very few physical copies. But they're going to be works of art, because the liner materials are going to be featuring the artwork of Greg Spolenka, and the layout's just gorgeous. All that music is inspired by Greek mythology. And as I said, it's vocal chamber music. So both of the sopranos I just named, Hila Plitman and Sangeeta Kaur. And then we've got strings, the beautiful Lily Hayden on violin. My cousin, Virginie Davzac de Castera, is on viola. My cousin, whom I only met randomly here in LA, not knowing of her existence until 2 years ago. She's a distant cousin, but it's a beautiful story of coincidence, in which a mutual friend who had no idea there was any relationship or family relation between us hired her to premiere one of my works. And only after the premiere did she and I speak and discover that we were related.
Wow.
Amazing small world, amazing. And on the cello, Eru Matsumoto. And then there are two other pianists that share this project with me. Again, I've gone back to my beloved friend from the previous album, Robert Feast, who's just a pianist for pianists, an extraordinary talent. And then Brendan White, who's recording of The Sirens, is jaw-dropping. The Sirens is the opening track of this album, and the piano part is absolute murder. And he recorded it in just incredible, great effort and success in the end. But it's a really, really difficult piano part, which I myself was not going to be able to record. It was injuring me just to write it.
I can imagine. I can imagine. I mean, there are every now and then I listen to pieces of music and I listen to performances, and I imagine the mental and in some cases physical kind of challenge you put yourself through. I don't say torture or abuse, because that takes away from the music, but there's a challenge to it, that you've written it a certain way for yourself to be challenging, but then you know for accomplished people to play it, it's going to be a challenge as well. You don't want them to sit down and go, oh, I got this.
Yeah, I can't leave a pianist bored.
No, exactly. You can't go, I got this. It's got to be a little bit more than that.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's unique about this upcoming album, Mythologies, is I'm finally reaching out to another instrument that I had never recorded with before. And the beautiful flutist, Wouter Kellerman, is recording on two of the tracks. And what was really fun is that I had him explore the whole range of the flute. He plays the well-known soprano flute. He also plays the alto flute, and very, very cool, he plays the contrabass flute.
Oh, wow.
Which most people are unaware of, the sound of the contrabass flute. It goes down to low C below the staff, so it's the range of a cello.
Yes.
And it's the coolest sound, and he represents the voice of the god Poseidon with that flute.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time out of your afternoon and chatting with me. This has been absolutely amazing.
Oh, I'm so flattered that you have shown so much interest and did the homework to ask such pertinent questions. I'm really touched, and I would absolutely cherish every further opportunity to speak with you.
Wow, okay, great. Well, the next time you have anything going on, you are more than welcome to come back.
I'd be so happy to do that. Thank you so, so much, Hammond.
Thank you.
For more Beyond the Playlist, you can go to jhammondc.com. You can follow me on Twitter at jhammondc. You can email the show, jhammondc@gmail.com, or you can find the Facebook group, Beyond the Playlist with J. Hammond C. The theme music is by MFTJ, featuring Mike Keneally and Scott Shore. More recordings from MFTJ are available on Lazy Bones Records. See the link in the show notes for more fine releases from them. The cover art is by Phil Grube. If you like the show, you can support me at patreon.com/jhammondc. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Playlist.